Well, looking back at the last year, I wonder what are some disappointments for you, or brought a frown to your face. And if you think of something, just raise your hand and shout it out. You know, as I thought about this past year and looked at the news and so on, suddenly in Canada, we're not a measles-free country. You know, and that is a disappointment, a frown. And I looked at this morning's news, last night's news, about, again, the dislocation of a First Nations community in Manitoba, 4,000 people dislocated because they have no drinking water. That is so sad. We take water for granted here, where we live, and they have no safe drinking water. Another disappointment, another frown, is that from having a close, friendly relationship with our neighbors to the south, now there is a sense of increased apprehension and perhaps caution as well. Okay, let's move to something more pleasant, shall we? What brought a smile to your face? You know, I was surprised, for example, how much determination there was within Canada to preserve our identity. And furthermore, that we are a united country. And I thought, well, that is really good. You know, there is need in our country. There are people on the streets who go hungry, who are unhoused. One of the things that I observed was that also in our country, there's a tremendous amount of goodwill, a desire to help those who cannot help themselves. And I thought, wow, that is wonderful indeed. You know, I also smiled as I thought of Annie Rauda. Do you remember her in the news at all? She was in the news here in London. She found $1,000 at a drive-in ATM machine. Someone had gone by and left the money, taken out their card, left the money behind. And, you know, that would be like a windfall, right? A minor win of the lottery. But she took the money and went back into the office and handed the money back in to the tellers and said, I found this money someone left at the ATM. She's a real estate agent, and I'm sorry that this is only her Christmas greeting card. I'm not advertising her business or anything like that. But you know, I thought, well, isn't this wonderful that someone would do that when you'd be tempted to say, this is nice. I could use that money. Okay, let's take a giant step back in time in terms of history and what stood out, what stands out for us as human civilization. What would you say are the greatest events that have changed the world? And, you know, people might say, well, surely it's fire or the discovery of the wheel. Any other guesses of what it might be? Well, absolutely. The Gutenberg Press in a town called Mainz in Germany. He was Frederick Gutenberg who discovered or manufactured the first press. And it was huge because before the press in Europe, the literacy rate was, what do you think? 5%. Only 5% of the population could read and write. The people who could read were clergy and the wealthy elites. And no wonder the clergy at one time were called the parson, or old English term for the person. In any community, the parson was the person who did everything, who could read, who could dispense medicine, who could read letters, everything else like that. And the printing press suddenly contributed to Martin Luther and the Reformation, together with gold and resources from the New World, meaning the Americas. It helped Europe come out of the Dark Ages into the Renaissance, and you have works like those by Leonardo da Vinci and Shakespeare and so on. Let's take another big leap forward, shall we? Let's come to 1969. There was an unprecedented event, and a number of world leaders said, this is the greatest accomplishment in human history. Any ideas what that might be? Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. He uttered his rehearsed lines and muffed it up. He said, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. He meant to say, I'm sure, one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. Those are sort of general world history kind of things and Canadian history kind of things. But when we come to our faith, what would you say is the giant leap for us as humankind? What is the heart and soul of our faith that has changed the course of human history? Now, go ahead, Barbara. Sorry? The resurrection? Sure. You know, here there are no real wrong answers. Some would say, surely it is the cross and the resurrection. Jesus gives his life that we may live. We could not possibly earn our way into heaven. And in his words, greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for a friend. By sheer unmerited grace, we have a relationship with God and a new life. And to use the language of John's gospel, we are saved. For the Christian church in the West, this has been the central fact, the cross. Calvary is our holy of holies, and of course with that, the resurrection. But interestingly, in the Eastern Church, the focus has been on Bethlehem rather than Calvary as a central place that reflected who God is. And it is reflected in their architecture and in their art. And so you have, for example, at the top of a lot of Eastern churches, a great big dome. And if you look up at the dome, in the center of the dome is a picture of Christ. And to go back to the Greek, the Pantocrator, or the creator of all things. And here is, for them, the greatest fact of human history, that God, the God, the creator of our expanding universe, stepped into our world in human form. To me, that is also utterly amazing. Here is a vast expanding universe, and in relation to that, our earth is but like a speck of sand on the seashore. And here is God, the creator of everything, who steps into our world from the vastness, the unlimitedness of the universe, steps into our world and is found as a baby in Bethlehem. And our hearts grow still and silent, and we are awed by the wonder of it all. Some might say it's a matter of chicken and egg, which comes first kind of thing. But for me, the Bethlehem event, the incarnation, God coming into our world, speaks masterfully, wonderfully, of his care for us, of his love for us, of his desire to connect with us in a meaningful way. And in that passage that Daniel read for us, some say verse 14 is really the heart of the Gospel of John. That it is, the whole Gospel of John can be condensed in that one verse. And sometimes we pass over it so quickly. And it says this, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth, and we have beheld his glory. It is far more dramatic than any other world event. God of the universe born in our midst. And all through history, people of faith have experienced God's presence and power in various ways. And we are filled with wonder that at what God can do. And yet this is extraordinary. Think of events in the past where people have said, this is where God is at work. We think of the Exodus and Moses, who leads a few hundred thousand escaped slaves out of tyranny in Egypt. And they're chased by the armies of Pharaoh. Behind them are the gleaming chariots chasing them, and in front of them is the Red Sea. And they have nowhere to go. And God is there. And the sea is parted, and closed. There is a wonderful miracle that they sing about. Or think of their continuing journey of the Exodus. The bitter waters of Marah are made sweet. They're fed with quail and manna. They have a tower of fire by night and a cloud by day to lead them through the trackless desert. At Rephidim, water gushes out of a rock. When they arrive at Sinai, God asks Moses to join him up in the clouds of Mount Sinai. And through Moses, God gives those simple nomadic people a remarkable symbol of his presence. He asks them to build a special tent. He gives them precise dimensions of how it should be built, where it should be built, and so on. And he says, I will consecrate the tent of meeting, and I will dwell among your people. God says, I will be in that tent, so you will know I'm never far away. And for them, it was a remarkable symbol of God's presence, a source of strength. But too often in our kind of world, it seems that God is far away. Where is he? It seems that he's absent and silent, unwilling or unable to do anything. And that is how the crowds mocked Jesus as he hung on the cross. Where is your God now? They laughed. If he is there, he would bring you down from the cross. Where is he now? Those are the kind of questions that troubled Dietrich Ritschl when it seemed that his life hung in the balance. As a teenager, one December night in 1944, he witnessed the carpet bombing of Dresden. And he says, many thousands of people died that night. And after the worst was over, I found myself lying with my head on a suitcase in a waiting room of a railway station. The roof was cracked, and I saw the flames leaping up, and my eyes caught the inscription on the ceiling. It was a quotation from the romantic poet Friedrich Schiller, and it said this, "Beyond the stars, there must live a gracious God." And he looked at that over and over again. Beyond the stars, there must live a gracious God. It was not a strong expression of faith. He was saying, beyond the stars, somewhere out there, there must live a gracious God. And Dietrich Ritschl says, I shook my fist at the sky, saying, I don't want that kind of God who hovers above the clouds and does not care. I want a God who is with us when the bombs fall, where the iron curtains are, where all courage and confidence and strength are gone. I want God there and nowhere else. Much later, as a theologian trained in Germany and Switzerland and Edinburgh and later teaching in Montreal and Union, New York, He writes this. He says, this God mixes with us. He's one of us. Even before he speaks, even before he demands anything of us, he comes and is with us. He was in the terror of that night. He was in the rubble and the screams. He was with those who suffered and those who call on his name as they died. Is God really there? Or are we holding on to some vague superstition to deal with our fears? After all, you know, you think beneath the bright sparkling surface of the sea, In its murky depths glide the vengeful monsters depicted by Melville in Moby Dick or by Peter Benchley in Jaws. I know now when I go to the ocean, I almost always look out to see the wider expanse of water. What might be gliding there? And what is in that water? Perhaps they represent our irrational fears. Or you think that out of the deep South Atlantic and Caribbean, the power of death and darkness concoct huge spirals of hurricanes and sets them loose with their screaming winds to wander erratically, killing and destroying. Blights and disease attack plants and animals. You think of the culling of 60 ostriches in BC and so on. Or the death dealers or mysterious new viruses like COVID, which creep into our organs and bloodstreams. We can see the power of death and darkness in the hatred that fuels forms of ethnic cleansing. It wells in on us in the form of dark, brooding anger or cold, gray loneliness. And we think, there's no one else but me. No one who understands me. And for some, it takes the form of black, debilitating depression. You know, during the Christmas season, perhaps you have sung what is really one of my favorite carols, the beautiful carol, "In the Bleak Midwinter." And we can relate to those words. They relate to us here in Canada. They seem to describe a Canadian winter. But you know, when Christina Rossetti and her family, who originally came from Italy and settled in England, when she wrote those words, they described the heaviness of her mood and spirit, her gloom and depression after death in the family. So here again those words with that background. In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. Earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. Snow had fallen, snow on snow, snow on snow, in the bleak midwinter. Long ago. Where is God when we are bereft and can hardly bear the grief in our hearts? Where is God when there is pain and suffering in our lives and in the lives of the innocent? Where is God in pain and the kind of suffering which seems over the top, egregious, for no reason at all? And we'll come to some of those issues in the coming weeks. But I wonder if there have been times, even in the midst of uncertainty, when you have experienced the presence of God. And I hope you'll speak to me afterwards, because I'd like to hear about it, and perhaps you can share that with a larger congregation. When you've experienced the presence of God in a marvelous and wonderful way, that comes as a wonderful and amazing gift of grace. And you sense in the midst of your confusion and fear that God is very near. Angela, was it 12 years ago I had my detached retina? You know, I was working on my sermon, finishing off my sermon on a Saturday night, and suddenly it seemed like there was a black curtain descending upon my eye. My vision, and above that dark curtain I could see nothing but blackness. My sermon was done. I gave it by email, or maybe actually you delivered it to an associate who said she would read it the next morning. I went to the ER in Kitchener, and fortunately an ophthalmologist was there, and he said, "Oh, you must make haste. Go immediately to the Ivy Institute in London." When we arrived at the door, the surgeon was waiting at the door. He said, "There's a lot of paperwork, but you and your wife can finish that after I'm done." After sedation and freezing, the surgery went ahead without any delay. I didn't know it as much as I do now, but time was of the essence. When the retina is detached from the back of the eye, the retina does not have vital blood supply, and it can shrivel up and die with permanent loss of vision. When the surgery was all done, a nurse came in and removed the bandages. She held up her hand and said, "How many fingers do you see?" And my spirits rose with expectation. And I blinked my eyes open and looked and stared. I could see nothing. There was a thick white cloud. I said, "None." And she repeated that 3 times with the same outcome. And then she abruptly left. Perhaps the procedure had been a failure. I expected to see, you know, like in the movies, they remove the bandages, you know, and suddenly there's an exclamation, "I can see." But I saw nothing. Would the other eye also go the same way? Because I knew the other eye was weaker. It meant I would not be able to read and work and have to walk with a cane or someone lead me by the hand. My alarm and fear ratcheted up. And then I thought to pray. I don't know why I had waited that long, but suddenly there was a massive, an unexpected calm and a sense of God's presence, that He was there with me. And whatever the outcome, whatever happened, it would be okay. God was present there in my sense. Some of you have been there and discovered that you are not alone. In the loneliest, toughest situation or experience in life, you know that there is another presence. As with Daniel in the lion's den, suddenly there is another presence there, and the all-sufficient God upon whom we can lean. That is our experience of God. Not all the time, sometimes, as a great, rare gift. He's not on some mountaintop, somewhere beyond the stars, looking unconcernedly down at our troubled world like we might look down at a few puppies that are frolicking around on the ground at our feet, tumbling over each other. There are moments when the world feels unsteady, when grief lingers, when fear speaks loudly, and the future seems so unclear. And at times, in those times especially, we may wonder, where is God? Whether we are walking this road alone. And the heart of our faith answers clearly, God is with us, not far away, not waiting for us to be stronger and more faithful, but present here, right now. And His name is Emmanuel, God with us. And it's not just a Christmas promise, but a daily one. God is with us in those questions that have no easy answers. God is with us in those long nights and quiet tears. With us in the hospital rooms in moments of loss and seasons of waiting. And God is with us not only in sorrow, but also in strength, offering courage when we feel depleted, peace when anxiety settles in, and hope when the road ahead seems so uncertain. The promise of God's presence does not mean that suddenly everything will make sense, or everything will fall neatly into place, that there are no more loose ends. But it does mean this: we do not face anything alone. God is with us. You know, I spoke to 2 folk in our congregation this morning. I was reflecting on what Bev had said about her grief as a church with Al's and Charlie's retirement. And of course, you know, we look around, we know that people are getting old, some are getting older and frail, or others have moved away. What do we do in the context of grief as a church? What does the gospel say to us, but to continue living with faith and joy. And beyond our immediate problems, to ask ourselves, what does God want us to be in this community? How can we align ourselves with his promises? Remember the words of the psalmist, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me." God is with us. That is the comfort we cling to, not that the valley disappears, but that God walks with us through it. Whatever burden you may be carrying, know this: God is near. God is faithful. God is with us now and always. Let us pray. Gracious God, there are so many times when we wonder where you are in the midst of our own anxiety and pain and loss. But we give thanks for the witness of the gospel, for the witness of so many who have experienced your presence and can say, God is with us. We pray with thanksgiving in Christ's name.